Hey nerds, we understand you. Drop those controllers, lose the wizard hat, and ready your Cheetos. It's time for some hard-hitting talk about the movies, books, and games you love. So get ready, oh searcher of useless knowledge. It's time to step into the Geek Cave. Now, broadcasting from a top-secret and totally awesome hidden base, I'm Ken Harris, and here's Darren Wright, Justin White, and Chad Savage.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Geek Cave Podcast Movies. I'm Darren.
I'm Justin.
I'm Chad, and we're brought to you by Shirtosaurus, digging up clothing from the past so you, yes, you, can look rad today with free shipping on all orders within the U.S., plus great t-shirt, sweater, and hoodie designs on everything geek chic. Whether you're a fan of Sega, Nintendo, RoboCop, Dragon Ball, or something in between, find something for you at Shirtosaurus.com. Also, we're brought to you by Gamefly, your destination for new and used video games, now with new membership options for everyone, including elite plans for you, so you can always get the newest game, or a budget plan, also for you, to help you save some cash. Plus, their store now carries Lego products. Gamefly has thousands of titles that you can keep as long as you want without worrying about late fees. When you're done, just send it back with the postage paid envelope for a new one, or pay a lot less than in-store prices and keep it forever. Sign up for a free 30-day trial right now using the link at geekcavepodcast.com. Extra life is coming, peeps. Head over to geekcavepodcast.com. Click on the link to donate to help sick kids. All money goes to the Children's Miracle Network, and a donation of any amount gets you entered into a drawing for one of several fantastic prizes. See the previous 2 days' podcast to hear more about what we're offering. A donation of $40 or more will earn you a custom sketch from our very own Justin White, and a donation of $1,000 or more gives you the right to choose what game we'll play during our shift, so long as we can find it.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Justin,
yo.
I have been busy. My social calendar has been totally upended. Allow me to live vicariously through you. Tell me that you have been to a party.
Oh, yeah.
Hit it! Pilot party! Pilot party!
Pilot party!
So, the last couple of pilot parties I've done haven't been stellar.
Mm.
And I'm referring to the shows, not my contribution.
No, of course. Well, I didn't say anything.
No, I know. I'm just clarifying. So I thought today I would do something a little bit more fun.
Oh, okay.
So what happens when the prettiest and most available boys at the richest private school have too much time on their hands? They start a host club.
I've seen this.
Welcome to Ouran Academy, where the rich and famous of the world send their kids to seek higher education and possibly love. Wink. But what happens if you're neither rich nor famous? Enter new scholarship student Haruhi. We find Haruhi wandering the school looking for a quiet place to study. The school has 4 libraries, but they're all busy with socializing students.
Ugh.
Haruhi finds an abandoned music room. Surely this is quiet. Nope. It's become the home of the Ouran High Host Club. What's a host club, you ask?
What is a host club, I ask?
Well, thank you for asking. It's a group of eligible young men who provide company and affection to eligible young women.
Wait a minute.
Non-sexually.
Okay, I was about to say, is this an escort thing?
Non-sexually. They just sit there and dote over them.
So it's a legal escort thing.
Yes.
Okay.
Surprised and a bit shocked, Haruhi doesn't know what to do when approached by the group's leader, Tamaki. He's flamboyant, narcissistic, and absolutely dedicated to his duties in the club. Haruhi is flustered and stumbles into a pedestal holding an 80 million yen vase. It breaks. From the moment Haruhi enters this room until the moment the vase falls, whenever it's on screen, a flashing red arrow points to it as if to say, "Plot device!" The group decides that since Haruhi has no money to pay for the vase, they'll become the group's errand runner. It's soon apparent that Haruhi has a natural talent for entertaining the ladies and is promoted to host in training. If they can get 100 clients, the debt is forgiven.
Does he become a super host in training or the shit?
Haruhi makes an enemy of Princess Ayanoki, Tamaki's number one client. She's jealous of all the attention Tamaki is giving Haruhi. Time spent with anyone else is time taken away from her. She accuses Haruhi of attacking her. Tamaki and the others see through this and banish her from the club's services. However, as a result, they raise Haruhi's debt to 1,000 clients. Throughout the episode, we see a bank of darkened light bulbs, one for each of the club members. As the episode goes on, the bulbs turn on one by one. At the end of the episode, the last bulb, Tamaki's, turns on, finally realizing that the slouching short-haired boy is actually a slouching short-haired girl. Gasp! Shock! This is a fun show.
All right.
It's lighthearted anime with an interesting plot hook. Something you can put on and enjoy without a lot of drama.
Okay.
And now for my prediction. As the series goes on, all the host members come to care and love Haruhi. Tamaki in particular. He confesses his love and they eventually get married. On their wedding night, Tamaki discovers that Haruhi isn't actually a slouching short-haired girl, but in fact a slouching short-haired potato. This doesn't bother Tamaki and they live happily ever after. I give it 5 out of 5 broken $8 million yen vases.
All right.
Well, you're not too far off on your prediction. As someone who has watched the entire series and read the entire, 17-issue manga.
Man, he's really making progress on those manga moments.
He is.
Yeah. So, well.
Listen to the comic segment.
Indeed.
Please.
Callbacks.
I need all of the help and personal praise I can get.
Yeah.
Please listen to the comic segment.
Well, it wouldn't be a good show if it didn't have continuity. So,
well, to be fair, we also pay Justin in validation.
Yeah,
usually it's
true.
Just his parking, but sometimes we tell him that he's doing a good job.
This is true.
I only have the one stamp, though.
I got a shoulder. You can stamp it.
Okay. All right.
All right, gentlemen. We have four choices ahead of us. Review. Watch this again in its original form. It was good then. It's good now. Reboot. The idea is sound. Let's get some new writers. Tackle the concept anew. Revive. Yeah, what does this look like 30 years later? With the same cast. Or refuse. Chad, you do this again and you're out of the cave.
Okay.
So this show was a spinoff of Perfect Strangers.
Oh, Lord.
Featured a black family as the center of the show.
Oh, okay.
And midway through the first season, introduced a nerdy neighbor who eventually became the main character. It ran for 9 seasons, being the second longest-running live-action U.S. sitcom with a primarily African-American cast, trailing behind only The Jeffersons in terms of seasons, which was itself a spinoff of All in the Family. So I would like you to consider Family Matters. Following the Winslow family and their quirky neighbor Steve Quincy Urkel, this show started as a typical family sitcom in the early seasons, developed into a more fantastic series as it went on, with all kinds of science fiction, fantasy kind of stuff thrown in, and along the way dealt with the various realities of being a family and the ups and downs that come along with it. It didn't shy away from the racial realities of its cast, and also didn't shy away from just doing regular sitcom-y stuff. So, where do you sit? Review, reboot, revive, or refuse?
I think a revival or a reboot of this show would not have the same charm as the original did, nor would it. I think it would be far more cynical than it was back then, because like you said, I'm thinking of two episodes in particular, and they couldn't be more different from each other. Mm-hmm. One is when Steve Urkel clones himself into a more suave version of himself called Stefan.
Stefan Urkel.
The other is when Carl's oldest son, I don't remember his name.
Eddie.
Was it Eddie? Eddie, yes. Eddie gets harassed by a police officer. although he is the son of a cop because he is black. Mm-hmm. And so you've got two entirely different moods, entirely different types of episode, but both work within the confines of the show. This is a hard review for me. I would watch this. Do all the jokes hold up? No, this was made in the 90s. But is it still a damn good show? Yeah, I could watch this today with no problems whatsoever. I think that a reboot would probably miss the point. And I think that a revival would not... I think a revival would kind of tarnish how the show is seen now, because they'd try to go a little bit too serious like they did with the Connors, you know, post-Roseanne, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. This is a full-on review for me.
I'm going to go with revival, okay. But...
All right.
With only the youngest daughter, Judy Winslow, who went upstairs to her room one season and never returned.
Yeah.
End of season five.
Yeah. The original actress who played the mom, who was replaced for like the last season.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And Aunt Rachel, who went off leaving her small child to be raised by the Winslows.
So just those three and
just
no one else?
Just those three, yes.
What are we going to call it? The Disappearing Act?
No, Family Matters.
Well, my family don't matter. They all left. All right. I need more on this. All right. What's this show going to look like?
Think Golden Girls, but.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
You weren't prepared to be challenged on this, were you?
No, I wasn't. Also, it is my personal headcanon that Reginald Vell Johnson's character, mm-hmm. Carl Winslow, is actually Sergeant Owl Powell from the Die Hard movie, and this is him in Witness Protection.
Yeah, I sign off.
He moved
that.
From L.A. to Chicago, still managed to get into the police force. They're in on it, but now he's Carl Winslow.
Yeah, I'd be okay with that.
His oldest son, Eddie, is the baby his wife was going to have during Die Hard.
You know what? Why not? Why not? No, that would explain part of why he's so frustrated with Steve Urkel, because Steve Urkel, being the ridiculous genius he is bound to spill the beans.
Yep.
You know, which is why later on they turn themselves into Bruce Lee. I'm with Darren for the most part on this. I think this is a review. I grew up watching this show and loving it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
If it was if there was a revive, I'd want it to be like a single episode revival.
Yeah, like
that's
a reunion.
Just you know, and you can make the coming back together serious or silly. You know, I would almost see it as okay, they're selling the house.
Yeah.
You know, and moving. And so that's the ending, you know.
Yeah. Like, don't give me Fuller House.
No, I don't. I don't need a Family Matters More series.
That's totally what they would call it.
Yeah. More Family Matters.
No,
yeah.
Family Matters More.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
There
yeah.
you go. Yeah.
So, all right. Cool.
Good one.
I like that one. All right. Time for a bit of Trailer Park Roundup. Not nearly as much as there typically is, because I was getting really tired of watching horror trailers. So.
Yeah.
All right. Jungle Cruise. Only Dwayne Johnson and Emily Blunt could possibly make this look as fun as it is. And it looks really fun.
I can agree. I've seen that trailer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, which one did you watch? Because they did two of them. One that focused on Emily Blunt and one that focused on Dwayne Johnson. And the two of them premiered at like the same time, competing against each other for the better trailer.
I've seen the Rock one. I have not seen Emily's.
I don't remember.
They're mostly the same, just little differences here and there to try to make one of them look less capable than the other. And well worth the time. All right. Encanto. Don't you love it how most Disney-style movies seem to start with abuse before they shift to any notion of acceptance?
Yeah. Yeesh.
In this one, a place in which everyone is special, instead of Mirabel, and the trailer wants to ensure that we all know that Mirabel has no gifts. It's really bright and cheerful, and I hate the setup.
I'll still see it.
Oh, I probably will too, but I don't like the way the trailer is setting it up.
Right.
Habit. Any trailer that starts with a bunch of foul-mouthed nuns beating the shit out of a mugger, it's got my vote for a second look. I don't know what else this movie's about, because I was laughing too hard at that opening to watch the rest of the trailer. Clifford, the big red dog.
I did see this one.
Me too, yeah.
Is proof that some children's books should not be made into live-action movies. Because Clifford is GD terrifying.
Oh, well, yeah, he is scary, but I kind of want to see it.
Yeah. It's got John Cleese in it.
Yeah.
John Cleese doesn't save everything he's in.
This is true.
Take him to the city. Nobody will notice.
Turning Red. A Disney Pixar movie that has me intrigued as it seems to include a kid that turns into a giant red panda when she gets anxious.
I've seen the poster. I have not seen the trailer.
Oh,
yet.
The trailers. Yeah.
For when you need a kid-friendly Hulk movie, I guess. Addams Family 2.
I think you mean Addams Family Values.
No.
This is like the animated.
I know.
Yeah.
I really wish people making movies with established characters would at least respect the freaking characters. For example, the newest Star Trek movies just couldn't wait to destroy the Enterprise. That's supposed to hurt when the Enterprise breaks. Now, the Addams Family. They can't wait to disrespect the Addams Family. You know, the key to the Addams Family is that they're always completely supportive of each other, even if they don't understand.
Right.
They're a unit. The first cartoon movie, they decide that Gomez wasn't going to be supportive of Pugsley, or Morticia was going to prevent Wednesday from somehow going to school. Now, in this movie, the trailer indicates that the kids are somehow distancing themselves from their parents, and so they're going to go on a road trip to reconnect. Gah! This is fine for Mitchells versus the Machines, but not the Addams Family. You want to make an Addams Family road movie? Fine. Gomez plans the yearly honeymoon for he and Morticia, and they decide to take the family along because it's time that the kids get to experience the joys and wonders of Transylvania. A mix-up happens, and instead they end up on a Caribbean cruise. Throw in a long-suffering cabin boy and a cruise manager that doesn't like their look, and voila! An Addams Family road movie, and that was off the top of my dome.
I'd watch it.
Yeah,
I'd totally watch that. See? Also, go watch Mitchells and the Machines.
Well, yes, watch Mitchells versus the Machines, but you can tell that that would not be a good Addams Family movie. Ugh. All right. I've got a lot of reviews. Do you guys have any reviews?
Not that I know of.
I've got just a brief spoiler-free review of season one of Loki.
I would love to hear it.
Okay. Loki is quite possibly the best Marvel show on Disney Plus right now. It clearly has the biggest budget. Tom Hiddleston is still fantastic in his role. And I'm not giving too much away. It has to do with timelines. It has to do with, you know, different timelines. It's really setting up Multiverse of Madness. There's a great surprise appearance by... who ends up being the big bad at the very end in episode 6. It is a 6-episode miniseries, but the good news is, unlike WandaVision and Captain America and the Winter Soldier, or Falcon and the Winter Soldier, whatever you want to call
Bucky and the Birdman.
Bucky and the Birdman. Loki is getting a season 2. That's exciting. And my spouse was a little disappointed with how the last episode ended because it's not like... Because it is a continuing series, there's not going to be like a full-on resolution of things, but it is setting up a whole lot of stuff, and what it's setting up is very exciting. Also, Tara Strong is in this show. She voices a sentient clock, and if that isn't enough to get butts in seats, I don't know what is. Because Loki is fantastic. It's the best done show on D+ right now as far as the Marvel Cinematic Universe goes. It's not as good as the movies, but it's a real strong B+, like right under an A-. Highly recommend you watch it.
Cool.
Awesome.
Tara Strong's sentient clock, because the chances of you being killed by a clock are low, but they're never zero.
Oh, and there's also an alligator, and that's all I'll say.
Right on. Hey, Justin, you studied history, right?
Yes, I did.
Have you seen America, the motion picture?
No, I haven't.
Don't. In the name of all things sacred and holy, do not watch this with anything close to a knowledge of American history. the ignorance that has to be brought into the experience of watching this film is so complete that it is actually painful. The premise of this film is that after being betrayed by Benedict Arnold, who is a werewolf, by the way, the people present at the Declaration of Independence signing are killed by the British. Shortly thereafter, while taking in a play together, Abraham Lincoln is killed in the presence of his dear friend George Washington. And Abraham Lincoln tells George Washington that he has to beat the British, the fun police, and unite the nation. Washington wants to quit after every setback, and he is joined by a team. Sam Adams, a frat guy, Thomas Edison, a Chinese-American woman, and Paul Revere, the, quote, fastest racist in the colonies, who is called this because he races horses. Think neon on the horses, like Fast and the Furious Tokyo Drift kind of vibe. This is so grossly offensive to people on every point of the political spectrum, it should not be watched by anyone.
Oh, my God.
It's claiming to be a satire, but it has no point to make. The only good part of this entire movie, except maybe Paul Bunyan fighting a robot Big Ben, or Tower of London, Elizabeth Tower, is Washington's weapon of choice are twin wrist-mounted chainsaws.
Okay, I know what you said, and I heard you, and yet my interest is piqued.
It is so bad. It is so obscenely bad that the entire time you're trying to find out what is the point. Unless the entire idea of to satire is that the American populace is so friggin' benighted that they have no concept of their own history, which, to be fair, many don't. It is awful. Stay away from this movie. Instead, watch Gunpowder Milkshake. I did a review of this, the trailer of this one, on a previous episode. I got to tell you that this film, it's stylish, it's over the top, it's funny, and it is an absolute delight. Karen Gillan is excellent as a hit woman working for a mob-like group that finds itself on the outs. That's about as much story as you're going to get or need. It's all about the action, and it is worth the price of admission, a subscription to Netflix, just for the bowling alley fight. Just okay. For that. Rurouni Kenshin, the final. As with the prior live-action Kenshin movies, this is the way to do an anime live-action movie. It is just realistic enough to buy into the action. It's fantastic enough to overlook the 12-foot horizontal leaps from a standing start. And it is grounded enough to care about every character in the movie, including the villain. This movie covers the last arc of the manga. It is worth every bit of your time to see if you enjoyed the prior Kenshin live-action films. If you've not, don't bother. But if you like the other ones, this one is just mwah.
Nice.
All right. I enjoyed the television series Leverage, the first one that came out like 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I started watching it one time when I was sick. I enjoyed it enough to watch the whole series. After some years of being off the air, it's been revived, which much of the cast returning. And whereas the prior series was about vengeance, this one is about one of the characters seeking redemption for a lifetime of not picking sides, meaning that he was always siding with the rich, powerful bad guys. There's enough new things to make it work. There's enough calling back to the original series to feel like Leverage, and I doubt it will become a multi-season series, but it's definitely worth your time, again, if you enjoyed the original. Over the last 2 days, gentlemen, I have watched all three of the Fear Street movies that are on Netflix.
How are they? Because I want to watch them.
Long story short, if you like scary movies, this is absolutely worth your time.
Okay.
It is ridiculously gory. Like over the top gory a couple of times, but in more of a way that's more funny than scary.
Are we talking Tucker and Dale versus Evil levels? Or
No. It tries to be more grounded than that. There is a scene in a supermarket that involves a bread slicer that, when you see that happening, just avert your gaze for about 15 seconds and then be done. That's the worst one. It's in the first movie, and that's probably the most gruesome. There's one toward the end of the second movie where someone is killed with an axe that's also pretty gruesome, but it's done in a much more stylized way to kind of accent the brutality more than the goriness. The three movies are connected, but they tell different stories. So the first, Fear Street 1994, tells the story of Dina and Sam, ex-girlfriends who, after an ill-advised post-memorial prank, end up the target of a witch's curse. People die, more things are discovered, and supposedly they solve the issue, only for the curse to continue on and possess Sam, the one that they've been trying to save. So in this one, you've got two towns that are basically one town that's been split. So you got Sunnyside, which has all the good luck, and Shadyvale that has all, or Shadyside that has all of the bad luck. Right? The second movie, Fear Street 1978, tells the story of C. Berman, the only survivor of a massacre at Camp Nightwing. This one is better than the first one. It's darker, much darker, and it really captures the vibe of those 1970s slasher films. So if you dug on things like Friday the 13th, really, really well done. We gain a bit more insight into the witch's curse, how it works. There's a ritual, you know, you get this, they reveal there's a ritual where a name is offered and that person becomes a killer, right? For whatever reason. Movie snaps back to the 90s at the end where they, again, have an idea. Here's how we have to solve the curse. You know, the witch had her hand removed, and so if they reunite hand with body, then it should go away. In trying to do that, our character bleeds on the bones, which releases another hallucination, and we end that second movie in 1666, where she is now taking the place of the witch. And so the final movie gives us the origin of the curse of Seraphir and the way that things are tied together. I'm not going to tell you about this one. I'm not telling you much about any of them because this is like 2 days old, like 3 weeks old for the first movie to... You know, and I just want you to watch them. My favorite twist is the way the movie will shift our expectations. And if you've read any of the Fear Street books, you'll probably guess the twist before it happens, but it's still done well, and I won't spoil it here. Movies are worth your ride. There's a definite silliness throughout this stuff. I grew up in the 90s. The number of adults in this first movie is laughable. You know, there's a kid who's killed, and so they're going to have like this big, you know, memorial candlelight vigil kind of thing. One adult in the entire crowd of probably 150 kids. You guys were around in the 90s. How many school-sponsored activities can you name where there was one adult for 150 kids?
Well, it was public school, so the adults were clearly outnumbered, but...
But I bet there's more than one.
Yeah.
And that one was the sheriff. So, not a teacher at all. They took a school bus to get to it. So, clearly.
One of the kids drove.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, some of the Foley work on it is just hysterical. So, like, in one of the 90s sections, they're using super soakers. Hey, remember super soakers?
Yeah.
Because they're going to distract the monsters with whatever's in the super soakers. And for some reason, as the kid is pumping the super soaker, you get the sound of a shotgun.
No.
I don't know about you. My super soaker 50 never made that kind of noise.
Damn it. I knew that's where this was going.
You had to get the 100.
Yeah. The 100, that's when it cocks.
So despite a bit of silliness here and there, it's a well-thought-out trilogy. It's probably worth your time. If you like scary movies, these are very good ones.
Okay.
All right. And that is all of the reviews I got for those. So I think I'm just ready for the random movie review.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, what's up, Darren?
I've got one more thing.
And now it is time for Darren's Trivial Trivia.
Okay, so you remember Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And I made sure to use the full title.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
Do you remember how often Superman actually spoke in his own damn sequel?
No.
Yeah, well, I went and counted. So, Superman only had 42 lines of dialogue in the entire film. Sorry. 43 if you count his death stream.
Well, you should.
Comparably, Batman had 78.
Well, he got top billing, so that tracks.
And that piss poor excuse for Lex Luthor had 48.
So who spoke in this movie?
Who spoke?
Yeah, I mean, so Batman has 70-something. Superman has
78 lines of dialogue.
40-something.
Yeah.
Lex Luthor has 40-something. I mean, the movie's 7 hours long.
Yeah, so I didn't count Lois's lines. I'm pretty sure she had... Batman had the most. Batman had the most lines. I know that much.
My
I think
goodness.
Lois was like second.
Holy moly.
Going back and thinking about it, I think the rest of the movie is filled in with random people just saying Martha.
Yeah, there's that. There's times where Superman looks pensive or sad, or sad and pensive, or apprehensive, or apprehensive, if you will.
Apathetic?
Yeah. Or just pathetic. And I say this as someone who liked the film.
I'm just imagining now, like, you count all of the characters' different lines, and, like, the terrorist at the beginning has more than one of the principals.
I'm going to have to go back and count that now.
All right.
That's all I got.
One of these days, I'm going to remember that you have this segment, and don't count on it for next month. It is time for the Random Movie Review, Mr. Harris.
Oh, the lights are down low. The popcorn is hot. The drinks are cold. Settle in for the cinematic universe of Chad's Random Movie Review.
The roll of the dice. Next month, I will be reviewing Zoot Suit.
Riot.
Zoot Suit.
Riot.
Riot.
In the course of my life, there are movies that capture the imagination. There are movies that stun, shock, surprise, and sometimes even confuse. This is not one of those movies. This is Extinction, a 2018 sci-fi alien invasion movie with lots of explosions and a clever twist that I'm going to spoil the shit out of that just doesn't hold up. Our movie follows Peter, played by Michael Pena, who has been having nightmares in which aliens arrive and start blowing the crap out of everyone. These nightmares consume him through the day, making him absent even when he's present. So his relationship with his spouse, played by Lizzie Kaplan, is strained, as is his relationship with his daughters, whose names I didn't bother looking up. He starts hallucinating his nightmares at work, which also causes him some trouble with his boss, played by Mike Coulter. Convinced to go and receive psychiatric help from a clinic, he meets another patient who's been having the same nightmares. And so now he's worried that his visions are portents of the future, and he doesn't want the clinic to get rid of those visions, as they might save his life. That irritates his spouse to no end, as you might imagine. Disappoints maybe is more accurate. But it leads to some tension, because that's what this movie needs, is tension. Especially because they're hosting a party that night to celebrate one of her victories at work, an achievement, of which I have no idea what it was. It just seems to show up. As the party's winding down and nearly everyone is gone, the aliens attack. I know. Surprised me, too. You know, come to think of it, I might have actually had more respect for this movie if there was no alien attack. Like, it was really just all in his head and there was no attack at all, so all of the action-y bits get to stay in and they can bill it as this sci-fi action thing, but the story is just about his descent into lunacy.
It's like Fist of Justice.
Not what happens, but would have been nice. While hiding in their apartment, they're attacked by one of the invaders, who is somehow distracted by Peter's younger daughter, who's trying to find her doll. That distraction's enough for Peter to beat the snot out of the being and steal its gun. He can't use the gun because it relies on, like, biometrics in order to fire, but he steals it anyway, because there's got to be a point later on when they're trapped in a hallway and he's got to do some engineering stuff really fast while under fire in order to fix a gun, because we need tension. Anyway, based on Peter's nightmares slash visions, they make their way toward his work, a government building, so they assume it will be safe. Along the way, the wife is injured, because of course she is. The invader that he beat the snot out of, but left alive, reattacks and is beaten up again. Worst alien invader ever. But it's at this point that we are shocked, I tell you, to learn that the invaders are human.
Dun, dun, dun.
Forcing the human to carry his injured wife to safety, Peter is told by the doctors, "We can't help, she's too far gone." And the human says, "I can help," and we are shocked, I tell you, to learn that Peter's wife is actually an android.
Dun, dun, dun.
She needs an alternative power source, and that power source will be Peter, who is also, I'm no longer shocked, an android.
Dun, dun,
dun. Da, da, da. During the transfer, Peter's nightmare vision is revealed instead to be suppressed memories of the past. Because Damn. Humans are awful, when the huge number of synthetic humans begins developing sense of self, you know, actually developing being into actual beings rather than mindless machines, it's determined that they must be shut down before they attack the genuine human population.
Wait, I played this. It's Detroit Beyond Human.
Yeah, the thing about sense of self, it typically comes with a sense of self-preservation. So the synthetics, is that racist? Sounds racist.
Yeah.
It's fine. They fight back. Curiously enough, they win, and they drive the humans off-world.
You didn't call them the synthies, so it's fine.
I suppose. Afterwards, most of the emergent humans, there we go, that emergent consciences,
yes.
Choose to have their memories erased in order to live lives without fear of reprisal from the defeated humans. Waking up, the human tells Peter that the humans have been living on Mars for the past 50 years, planning to return and kill the monster synths, but he never expected that he would come back and find families with children. By the way, the whole children thing in that memory bit is children are advertised, like synthetic children are advertised as being just like the real thing. They laugh, they love, just like the real thing.
Oh, boy.
Of course.
Oh,
so,
boy.
So you get the sense that for the past 50 years, he's had this, like, six-year-old kid that's never gotten older and never developed beyond the six-year-old stage. And nowhere in this is it considered weird. So Peter and Alice, his spouse, they escape to a train with the rest of the group, and the movie ends with Mike Coulter explaining that some chose to keep their memories so that they'd be able... so they would be ready for the day that the humans came back, because humans can't let anything go. Train goes into a tunnel, and the credits roll. All right. In terms of the actors, Michael Peña and Lizzie Kaplan are great. Coulter doesn't have quite enough to do in this one, but his performance is solid. The children, they're little more than scream factories, as you might expect in a war movie, and everyone else is just kind of there. Despite there being moments of tension and action, which we must have, the movie just isn't quite there. The tension's a bit too obvious, the tropes are too easily spotted. Like, you don't even need to subvert all of them, just one would have been nice. As they're escaping the building, one of the scenes in this, they take a window cleaner's elevator. That would have been great if they just took it and made it all the way to the ground and things were going on around, but they ultimately made it. But having the thing actually break because it looks dangerous and rickety, it's too obvious. Do better. Michael Peña's character, Peter, is likable, but that's his entire personality. It's not enough to build a movie on. And by the time the credits rolled, it seemed more like the movie was meant to act as a setup for a sequel. So, I'll put this in different terms. The movie's 95 minutes long. I typically applaud a short runtime. It means the storytelling's tight. It has to, each scene has to have a purpose. This felt like spending a shootout, an hour in the shootout at the cantina, jumping to Luke's parentage, and then rolling the credits with the escape from Mos Eisley. Nothing was really accomplished, and okay. You got rid of the big twist.
Wow.
That's what this movie felt like. I wanted to like it, but in the end, this one's a don't be like me. So, thanks to our sponsors, Shirtosaurus and Gamefly. Don't forget to check out our other offerings. You Want Me to Watch What? Our less frequent TLDR. Retromantics and Geek Cave Plays over on YouTube and Twitch. Don't forget to donate to our Extra Life campaign. So for Kent Harris, our strong Buffy Summers, our Darren Wright, our smart, savvy Willow Rosenberg, Justin White, our grounded and funny Xander Harris, I'm Chad Savage, the dry and sardonic Rupert Giles. Thank you for listening, and remember, everyone is a geek for something.